your attorney that, look, I have all these statements that were made in public. I mean, you know, I've got the following witnesses that'll testify to there of that. Why don't we go and file a complaint if these statements were actually, and like I said, I'm not prepared to question you on the specifics, you know. I mean, you're up here testifying before this committee, and, you know, I believe what you're telling me. I'm not prepared to debate the specifics, but on your testimony, but if these statements were made publicly, then obviously you have witnesses.
Sir, when it's actually in the transcript of the case, you don't need witnesses.
Okay, all right, all right. It speaks to the transcript. Okay, let's stop there. Then why don't you...
If I may, we tried to recuse the judge with the statement where, in my mind, whether I was a party or not, if I would have observed a statement where a judge is threatening to take the monies out of the trust of a young man and pay it to his former law firm without a trial, and then say, we'll try this case in the next century, that was the heart of the recusal. And the man who heard the recusal, appointed by Judge Herman's predecessor, instead of someone out of county who didn't have a relationship with the judge, said effectively he was just kidding. But he wasn't. He took the money.
Now, who was Judge Herman's predecessor?
King. Stephen King.
It's King. Okay.
But, okay, if you have it in a transcript.
So here's my point, is when you follow the system and you try to get the judge recused, who's clearly biased, and it doesn't play because the system's broken, can you appreciate the notion how discouraging it would be to go one step further, which costs you a lot of money and a lot of time, when it doesn't even work at the recusal level? Can you appreciate when you think the system's broken, that maybe you just have to go through and have your trial and deal with the appellate courts? That was our reaction. We very well may pursue a complaint before the Judicial Conduct Commission, but you can appreciate the mindset that when the system doesn't work, when a colleague of the judge hears a recusal hearing, anything short of murder, that judge is not going to be recused. And I've seen it time and time and time again. And even when we tried to recuse him twice. The second time, Judge Scanlon heard the recusal, and there was a litany of other claims that demonstrated the bias of the judge. And Judge Scanlon, we in writing asked him to recuse himself. It was our right to do so. He refused to recuse himself. He denied the recusal, and interestingly enough, I talked about this small circle of friends. Within 10 days, he was the visiting judge filling in for Judge Wood in Judge Wood's court, an appointment which generated money for him. It's a small circle of friends, is my message.
Mr. Alpert, and I understand what you just said, but put yourself in my shoes. Let's say I'm a poor boy, can't afford the representation that you have, I just hire a lawyer off the street, and not privy to what you know about recusals and or your lawyer that knows the probate law backwards and forwards, and I just a plain Texas citizen hire a plain lawyer, and he or she does not know the merits of the case, and basically paying whatever he or she can pay. But you do have a transcript, and you do have remarks that are in that transcript, and I, as a layperson, would say, look, I don't have any more money. What, is it gonna be favorable to me to go forward? I, as a layperson, would probably say, hey, we have the transcript. Not knowing your attorney's interpretation of what you just told me right now, that hey, let's go. I mean, I don't have any more money. Let's go and try our chances. You see where I'm coming from?
I do, sir. But let me tell you that some of the other suggestions that I have relate to the Supreme Court establishing standards of removal, because I believe the standards of removal have more discretion with the CJC than we realize. When I see a circumstance where I've looked at the results of other complaints, the results that I've seen in this 7 or 8 years, very few removals. I've seen judges removed from a case, but not removed from the bench. Yet their conduct justified removal from the bench. I saw the recent one I mentioned, a public reprimand. And in the scope of a judge's life, you know, maybe that impacts his career, maybe it impacts an election, but I don't think it's quite as significant as removing a judge who clearly exercises bias, who issues rulings that have nothing to do with the law, prevents evidence from going into a case necessary for a defendant to defend himself, and where a judge such as Judge Wood literally becomes an advocate. We had circumstances where the judge was directing the other side as to how to do things on the record. It's wrong. He's supposed to be an independent fact finder. He's supposed to represent the interests of the state of Texas in applying the law in a balanced manner. But you see, from a party's perspective, if you're not likely going to get relief because the system is not responsive, then the answer to your question is, would that be another bad investment of time and money?
Mr. Alpert, and I understood your answer, and I appreciate it. But understand this, it is significant. My constituent living over on Avenue K, she's on Social Security. You know, she's on, you know, she has a small estate, and, you know, she feels as passionate as you did when you read your testimony. And she doesn't know that, you know, well, if we go forward, are we going to get a fair chance? She just wants to go forward because she's passionate, because she feels she's right. And that's what I'm talking about. And, you know, not knowing what the lawyers that deal in this thing on a daily basis, that my little old constituent over here hires a lawyer. He might not be the best male or female in this specific line of work as far as probate and guardianship and all that, but at least that person feels that he or she is right, and they have a transcript on public testimony given by a judge in their case. Go forward. Let's see. Let the chips fall where they may. Because they feel it's significant to them.
I think you've touched upon a good idea. I think that person, if they fill out the form and go in, are not likely going to get very far. But maybe we should give an avenue where somebody living on Avenue K or someone who has more significant assets at play can go and have their claim evaluated and possibly assisted to go before the CJC. I can tell you the probability of just simply taking the testimony and tendering it and complaining narratively to the CJC is not going to get you very far.
Well, but he or she doesn't know. You know that. You know that. But he or she might not know that.
Let's give him some help.
Mr. Chairman.
Are we going to get your testimony?
Yes, sir.
In
he said at the end, he's going to give it to us.
Okay. Thank you.
I have a few more suggestions, and frankly, I think you're right. I think if those people have the opportunity to have, you know, a group look at it who is learned about the subject and get some help, I think they should go. A whole lot of people don't get help that deserve it.
Senator Corona has a question as well.
I just wanted to assure you, I don't want you to leave here thinking we're not hearing you. If I had been through what you have been through, I'd feel exactly as you do. And I think we'd all be kidding ourselves to think the system isn't broken, in fact, badly broken. I followed that case of the Denton County judge, Judge Wendell. He absolutely should have been removed from the bench if what he's been accused of publicly is what, in fact, he's guilty of. And it's a travesty that all he got was a public reprimand. I agree with you. That is like publicly reprimanding a legislator. It would have 24 hours effect, probably at best. The good news is, as you come forward and you've spent your time here today, we've got a very honorable chairman who's straight as an arrow, and he'll take all this testimony along with the rest of us as a group, and especially appreciating the fact that you've made time for specific recommendations of change, and I can assure you that some positive movement will take place as a result of your time here today.
I thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I think that one of the big problems is discretion. And in a small circle of friends, discretion can be abused. I don't know if it's being abused at CJC. I've had no relationship with CJC. But I agree, this judge in Denton should have been removed. I believe that somebody should tell CJC, this is where the lines are. They cross these different lines. They're gone. There's a lot of people out there that will honor the position with duty and with integrity. And to have to deal with all the machinations that different people who are probate judges, or for that matter, any type of a jurist, abuse. They should be gone. There's many qualified people there to do that job, and we rely on them. The other suggestions that I have. That although the First Court of Appeals has held this to be the case, it should be clarified by statute that a guardian, trustee, or receiver, an appointee, has judicial immunity only for judicial functions, and the appointee should not have judicial immunity for fiduciary functions. The answer is really simple. This isn't patronage. It's a job. Do your job, Mr. Appointee. Take care of the ward. Take care of the trustee's interests. Communicate with them. And I ask you one simple question. Whose money is it anyway? Is it the judge's? Is it the appointee's? No, it's the ward's. And the people that have been designated by the ward to receive that money upon his demise, or in the case of a trust. I had big plans for my son's trust. I believe that all $3.5 million is probably gone now. And it's gonna be a multi-million dollar fight to get it back. But we're fighting for right. And I hope the legislature can help us make it easier for people to understand that all they have to do is follow the law and do their duty. I have a few more suggestions and I'll wrap up. An appointee should not be discharged by a judge and subsequently reappointed without agreement of all beneficiaries or a guardian in the case of a minor. I suggest that if a beneficiary or a guardian, in the case of a minor, and a grantor unanimously agree to remove a trustee, the probate court must honor a request and permit a new appointment as provided in the vacancy section of the governing trust instrument. The version of Texas Property Code 112.054, which became effective on 1106, should be amended to require that the judge take the actions petitioned to for by the beneficiaries if the request is one being made by or agreed to by all beneficiaries. Again, whose money is it anyway? In the case of a minor beneficiary, the request should be sufficient if made by a guardian of the minor. There should be no discretion left to the judge when beneficiaries are in agreement. In my case, the beneficiaries have been opposed to this litigation from day one. Trustee pursuing an agenda to enrich himself, and little did I know at that time, trying to strike a deal with Internal Revenue and ultimately striking a deal with Internal Revenue to try and get a bunch of money from them, because he figured that if they put forth a claim, I'd look at the cost of defense versus the cost of settlement, and unless it was dealing with issues of integrity, I would have settled. And he would have gotten 15% of that with a cap of up to $7.5 million. He was using the litigation to generate information that he didn't have to give to Internal Revenue. Who would be paying him for that information as submitted? It's mind-boggling to me. We've talked about recusals, so I won't reiterate that. Bonds. Texas Government Code 25.1034 requires the judge of a statutory probate court in Harris County to execute a bond, but it is unclear for what that bond will be responsible, including whether it will extend the trust being impacted by the court. That provision requires a $100,000 bond, but it appears that the courts in Harris County put up a $1 million bond. It also appears that the amount is different around the state. In addition, Probate Code 36 makes a judge's bond liable if the judge fails to use reasonable diligence in the performance of his duty in supervising personal representatives. That should extend to all court appointees. The judge has a job. It's simple. Do your job. This may already be the case upon court review, but to avoid challenge, it should be made clear by statute. The government code and or probate code and or trust code should be amended to make consistent the amount of the bond and to clarify that the bond applies to all matters before the statutory probate court. I will distribute the unabridged portion of my speech. I abridged it a little bit as we were going forward, believe it or not, trying to shrink it a little bit. But really? I'll distribute that, and I would appreciate it if it would be made part of the record.
You bet. It will be. Other questions? Thank you, Mr. Alpert. Let me ask you, I noticed all this is in Harris County, but from your witness card, you apparently don't live in Houston any longer. Did you used to live in Houston?
I lived in Houston for 20 years.
I see.
This case started in 1999. And to be very frank with you, I moved to Arizona. And one of the reasons why I moved to Arizona, a really compelling reason, is I felt a very heavy weight when I saw what this judge was doing. It became very clear to us in December 1999 when this judge permitted this alleged trustee to lie to him and take $138,000 of my children's money, never tell us where it went, and then take 70% of those proceeds. It became clear as my attorney and I communicated that this judge had an agenda. And although I was subject to this court because I lived here during that period of time, I needed a mental break. It was overwhelming to my family what was going on. So we moved to Arizona.
Does your son want to make any remarks? Do you have any statement?
I think all I need to say is that the entire statement has my blessings. And
tell us your name for the microphone.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's Roman Alpert, representing myself.
The new and improved version.
to tell you that the entire statement has my blessings, and maybe to emphasize to you that my brother's guardian and I, from the moment I turned 18, and my mother before then, were against the litigation, and to thank you for listening.
You bet. Thank you for appearing, both of you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. It is 13 minutes to 12, and our next witness is Judge Mike Wood of Harris County. Judge, I'm going to give you the option. Do you have any idea about how long you're going to speak?
My opening statement's not going to be very long, but I don't know whether it'll be questionable or speculative.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead then. You would identify yourself and who you represent and proceed with your testimony.
I am Judge Mike Wood. I am the judge of Harris County Probate Court Number 2. And that is the court in which I think all three cases have been mentioned to you today are pending. And I'm not going to talk about them at all because it would be improper for me to do so. I was outside. I didn't listen to anything said because it would be improper for me to hear an ex parte communication by a party to a case. So I was waiting outside. I've been the judge of Probate Court Number 2 for 13 years. I've been a lawyer for 33 years, I guess. And I am now on the executive committee of the National College of Probate Judges, which is a group that is dedicated to improving the probate and guardianship law around the country. I want to give you a little bit of background about the size of the probate business, if you will, in Harris County. It's bigger than most other places in the world. There are four probate courts in Harris County. Each of us have a staff of 10 people to assist us in doing our job. 30% of the cases filed in Harris County are filed in probate court number two, and also 30% in court one. Courts three and four only get 20% because they do the mental health docket. Right now I have about 2,700 cases pending in my court. That's 1,200 guardianships, some of which go on for years and years, some of which are fairly short. I have 1,500 estates, decedents' estates, pending at any given time. Some of them last 90 days and are closed, some of them last years. But they probably roll over enough that there are probably 4,000 new probate cases each year, so that gives you an idea of the size of the business. Years ago, a couple years after I was appointed in 95, I had the staff total the assets and the inventories that were filed for my approval for one quarter. And then they did it again 5 years later. Both times it was about $750 million. That's just the assets and the inventories, not necessarily the estates that I was really supervising. There, most of them were independent estates. But my court, Court 1, are probably among the busiest probate courts in the nation as far as an amount of business that we handle, the number of cases that we handle. The job of a probate court under Texas law is fairly simple. We supervise the administration of decedents' estates and guardianships. 98% of what I do, 95%, is assist parties in uncontested cases to comply with the probate code. And incidentally, I want to compliment the legislature. I don't know if there are any of you who were here when the probate code was originally passed, but it is among the best in the nation. It is a very good, comprehensive, detailed code. It allows citizens to freely dispose of their property without court interference at a very low cost. The filing fee for a probate case in Harris County is about $250, less than $250. And it can be opened and closed in 90 days. If it's not a taxable estate or an estate tax return, the attorney's fees shouldn't be too much. I heard recently that to file a will for probate in California costs $46,000. And it took a year and a half minimum, and the attorney's fees were another $10,000 during that. That's just a will, not a contested case, just to file.
Surely you misspoke. $46,000 to file a will for probate?
You remember Proposition 13, Senator?
Of course.
No increase in property taxes, so everything is pay-as-you-go out there. So they have to pay for everything with filing fees. So it's ridiculous. It's just ridiculous. Just to file an equivalent of a munificent title, they really don't have, but to get a $10,000, $100,000 CD passed down to the next person, beneficiary, costs $10,000 filing fee. That's just outrageous. So it's very expensive in other places. The other thing the Texas Probate Code does is provide a comprehensive supervision of guardians and of administrators that we appoint. Among the best in the country. There's some states where the first inventory is not filed for a year, and there's never an accounting filed. I couldn't live in a world where I was appointing somebody, giving them the power over someone else's property, and I couldn't even tell what they were doing. We make a lot of appointments, and I want to just run down the list of all the different kinds of people we appoint just so the committee would be familiar with it.
Judge, if I could, what I'd like to do, I've tried all morning to keep people kind of on message, and what our charge is and what we're interested in hearing from you and everybody else that appears before us today is examine and make recommendations to improve court oversight of fiduciaries appointed to make financial and personal decisions for wards, as well as those appointed to administer an estate or trust. So if you've got suggestions or recommendations for the consideration by this committee in that area, that's what we want to hear.
We're
not really interested in hearing who all you appoint.
Okay. We supervise very well now. There are issues concerning who I select and who I appoint. It's my choice who I appoint. And right now I have almost 200 people on the list of appointees. Some I appoint in very simple cases. Some I appoint in more complicated cases. And there's really no way for anybody to supervise that above me except an appellate court and the Judicial Conduct Commission. And that's working quite well. If I do something wrong in the appointment of a guardian or an administrator, then and somebody objects to it and I overrule the objection, they can appeal it. If they think I'm really doing bad and it's not a case that they're involved in, they can file a complaint with the Conduct Commission and they'll look into it. I don't know what additional supervision there could be. I've heard suggestions, well, maybe we ought to have an ombudsman to look at the inventories that you approve or the accountings that you approve and see if they're okay. Who's going to pay the ombudsman? If I have an estate that's been pending for 10 years and somebody's complaining about the accountings that have been filed for 10 years, who's going to pay the fees for that person to come in and look at everything and see if it's okay? I have a staff attorney who reviews every attorney's fee application before I look at it. I've written guidelines, as Judge Herman does. I provide, there can be no block billings. You're familiar with block billing. It's got the date and it's got a paragraph and then $1,250. I don't allow that. It's got to have the date, the thing that was done, the amount of time that it took to do it, and the amount of fee. So I can very easily go down and review the fees for individual things, decide whether they're reasonable and necessary, which I'm charged to do.
Let me ask you, if I may, Judge Herman suggested changing Section 666 to include this one sentence. In calculating reasonable attorney's fees, the court shall award fees only for the performance of legal services. Is that a proposed improvement in your judgment?
No, I don't think so. I don't approve attorney's fees except for attorney's work. That's why I have to have it individualized so I can tell. If an attorney takes the ward to the doctor, they can charge a fee for that time, but it's not going to be $250 an hour, their attorney's fee. And I tell people that want to get into the business of being a guardian, you need to have a staff that you can charge out at $40 and $50 an hour for the bottom line stuff. People get to probate court not really planning to. You have a big estate, a guy that's an independent oil man who becomes incapacitated. I had to appoint a trust officer from a bank to be the guardian. It took him 3 years and hundreds of thousands of dollars in fees to reduce that man's estate to cash so he could survive on it, because we couldn't, as a guardian, operate the oil business. If people plan, the probate code allows them to avoid the fees. I also don't agree with the idea that we should have a hearing on every fee application for over $5,000. The fee application has to be verified. In my case, it has to be detailed. What are they going to do at the hearing? If I set a hearing on every fee application over $5,000, I'd have to have a day a week doing nothing but having lawyers come in and say, well, read the fee application to me. I've already reviewed it, and it's verified. So there's really nothing. Now, if somebody objects to a fee, we have a hearing.
Okay, let me ask you this, because I think you've answered the question in a way that you agree with this proposal, but you said you didn't agree with the proposal.
I don't agree with it because I'm not sure what the definition of legal services is.
If a lawyer has it, clearly not going to the bank and closing an account.
If you're a guardian and you're a lawyer, and you go to the bank to close the account and open a guardian account, you have to do it. If a paralegal shows up, they won't do it. You have to be there. And then the bank says, well, I need to see the whole file. I need to send the file to my legal staff in Columbus, Ohio, or we can't, these letters of guardianship are not enough. So you're there 3 hours or so debating with increasingly high levels of people in the bank just to close the account as guardian and open a guardianship account. So that's why I'm concerned about saying only legal services. I'm not sure exactly what that is. I look at everything that's on the bill and I decide, well, why, you know, we ask them, why is this 5 hours for this? And that's what my discretion's all about. And if I'm abusing my discretion, there are ways to take care of that. I'm concerned about legislation that tries to define what's appropriate and what's not appropriate, because then you get a longer and longer definition and you have more and more cases interpreting the definition. The one thing I'll say about contested cases, there's always a winner and a loser. And I have the benefit that the legislature doesn't necessarily have, that I can't hear a case unless everybody is present before me. I can't consider anything unless everybody's here. That's why I wasn't here before when they were speaking. As long as parties have money, there are lawyers who will take the money to fight the fight. I try to limit it as much as possible. When people are coming in, mom's becoming incapacitated, and they're fighting over who's going to be guardian over mom. I point out to them right at the beginning, I have the discretion whether or not to pay your attorney's fees out of mom's money for you to fight over who gets to be guardian over mom's money. And I'm disinclined to do that. So understand that your fight over this is going to be at your nickel. And you know what? I've only tried less than 5 contested guardianship cases over just that issue in 13 years. it's no fun when you can't spend mom's money fighting over mom's money. There are ways that judges can limit the attorney's fees. As soon as I know about a contested case, I call them in. We have a scheduling conference. I set up a trial so that they know they're going to have to get ready for trial and the issues that are in the case. And we can't just keep on pushing things around and filing pleadings. But good lawyers file pleadings. Those pleadings have to be reviewed by my staff. They have to be reviewed by me. They have to be responded to. And on and on and on, it costs money. And I can't say, okay, you can't file anything else. That's not something I can do. So I've ruled, they appeal. Well, first they file a motion for rehearing because I was obviously mistaken. And then I rule again, and they appeal. And the appellate court agrees with me. And then I do the same thing a year later, approve a similar thing, and they say no. They come in, ask for a motion for rehearing, denied, appeal. Appellate court says, read the last opinion. And they do that over and over again. That is costing this estate money. I can't keep them from doing that. And so that's the problem. And when we hear about exorbitant fees, oftentimes they're not caused by the court. They're caused by the fact that parties are represented by counsel who file pleadings that have to be dealt with. And it takes a lot of time, a lot of court time, a lot of appellate court time. And I don't want to stop people from being able to do that, because sometimes there's a germ of truth. It's especially hard when it's an incapacitated, it's a person who doesn't have a lawyer, they're in their pro se, and they keep on saying the same thing over and over again. You start listening and you say, you know, we need to check into that. And then I might have to appoint somebody to check into it. We might find out that that person is right. There was a problem in that estate. So I don't want to come in here and say, with all these people that are talked to you for the last hour that are angry with me, that there's nothing wrong. There may be something wrong. In those cases, I may have made a bad decision, and there are appellate courts to decide that, and they will make their decision, and I'll abide by it. But I don't think the legislature can fine-tune my discretion without damaging everybody's opportunity to function under the probate code. It is a great code. The amendment that was done, I came on the bench effective a week before the new guardianship provisions came in. And they are very comprehensive and they are very good. They protect the proposed ward very well. And they also allow me the power to protect the ward, to require accountings and to require detailed information. So I'm not gonna say there's no changes, but the ones I've heard so far, I don't think are necessary. You need good judges to do their jobs. And if they're not doing their jobs, they ought to be removed, either by the voters or by the conduct commission.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Grant.
Judge, I've got just a few questions for you. Mm-hmm. I understand you to say that you don't want to see the legislature limit your ability to award fees. But the question comes, what do you do about the judge, the probate judge, who refers out services to friends, to acquaintances, to former law partners or former law firms? And not just in small amounts, but in substantial amounts. And we seem to have growing testimony that's a practice. It might, in fact, be a practice that you engage in.
Well,
what do you do about that?
One case is in the court here and was talked about here. I left that firm in 1986 and was on solo practice for 7 or 8 years. In Liberty County, the judge can't avoid having lawyers that are his friends appear in his court. There are 8 lawyers in town. He knows all of them. He goes to church with all of them. And they know their wives hang out together. So that doesn't really work. I have to appoint people I know. You don't want me to appoint people I have no idea whether they're competent. So I don't appoint people. In fact, in that case, I didn't appoint my former firm, to anything. But I have appointed lawyers from that firm to positions.
Well, that ties into something else we hear, is that, you know, amongst people that deal in probate matters, it is a rather incestuous group. I mean, it's small. People know one another. It is what it is. How? What are some of the ideas or options for enlarging that in such a way that you're dealing with qualified people to hear these issues, whether we're talking about recusals or other matters, to assure that as the obligation is passed around to someone else to handle matters, that it goes to a larger circle and that we don't have this problem of running from friend to friend?
I have nobody on my appointments list as a friend. I don't socialize with any of them. Maybe that's not true. Two or three of them I may have known before I was on the bench. But I don't pick friends. I'm harder on friends. Most judges are harder on friends than enemies. But anybody that wants to come in and ask for appointments, I'll talk to them. And if they look like they're good, I'm always looking for new people because it's hard to find somebody that's competent to handle a bad, contested replacement administrator where the successor's got to come in and sue the original administrator and get money back.
What exists right now, either in statute or in rule, that would prevent the kind of conflict of interest that Judge Wendell, I believe it was, up in Denton County, was recently reprimanded for? That was a case I'm sure you're familiar with.
I saw the article in the paper about it.
Where we directed fees, what were reported as substantial fees, to a firm that was formed and organized and owned by a woman who became his ex-wife. I don't know what the time.
I didn't really understand all that either. Yeah. Obviously, that's improper.
Other than maybe perhaps your feeling of good sense and propriety, which I'd like to think we all have, what is out there in law that assures us that there is a remedy for that? Because some would argue, I'd argue, that the public, if he was guilty of what was widely reported, that the public reprimand that he received, and you did mention that going through the Commission on Judicial Conduct is one way to deal with these things, certainly didn't seem like much of a reprimand to me.
Well, a public reprimand against a judge is a very serious thing. It's very difficult to get elected again after that sort of thing. That, I think, is the best thing. I don't know the facts of that particular case, but if a judge does something like that, the Judicial Code of Conduct says you cannot benefit personally from being a judge at all, or your family, period. I don't let my Christmas presents are brought up by lawyers, all kinds of Christmas presents. We send them away. We can't accept gifts, period. I can't go to lunch with somebody and have them buy my lunch. That violates the canons of ethics. But how do you enforce ethics? Only the conduct commission. You can't really write a book, maybe the Bible, that has a set of rules to go by that are very specific. Don't go into business with somebody that you appoint and give hundreds of thousands of dollars to. Because then there are going to be all these details you have to try to flesh out about what you can't do.
But wouldn't one way to help eliminate or reduce the likelihood of these kinds of problems be to establish some sort of threshold, perhaps a $5,000 threshold for approval by some outside body or review committee is entirely too low? Perhaps $10,000 is entirely too low. But when we get into numbers that are in the high five figures and six figures, referrals to the same individual or same firm, shouldn't those kinds of things come under greater scrutiny than is currently the process?
My decision to approve a fee of $500,000, if it's objected to, will be appealed to a 9-member court of appeals.
Who pays for the legal cost for that appeal?
The appellant.
Okay, meaning out of the estate?
No, it depends. Or the party that doesn't think the fees should be paid has to pay for the appeal. And if the appellate court says that's okay, they should be paid, then you can go to the Supreme Court. That's 9 more judges that will look at the issue and decide whether or not it's appropriate.
But at what cost? I mean, you're an expert on what it costs to work through the legal system. So if somebody has that kind of broad authority on the front end, and they make, by bad judgment or otherwise, they make the wrong decision, or they spend the money inappropriately, and they don't possess the ethics they ought to possess, I mean, what price does the individual pay, assuming they have the resources to even tap to move it forward through the appellate process? I mean, is that really a fair remedy?
Well, it is, because if they win, they can recover attorney's fees.
Not automatically, correct?
Not automatically.
Right.
But if the court says that what they did was right, then the appellate fees can be paid. They're going to win, and if they win, then the fee is going to be set aside. So they're going to get a financial benefit out of that. We have an adversarial system of justice, and it works very well, but it does cost money. Then one thing I want to say about probate, money is used as a weapon in probate court. Probate court is family court after death. Family court is very bitter, personal fights between husbands and wives. But probate court is after death, where you can't really resolve the personal conflicts in a mediation because one of the people is gone or incapacitated. But still the bitterness and fighting is going on in family court. And even though they lost to the jury and the trial court ruled against them and all the appellate courts ruled against them, they still think they're right and everybody else is wrong. And there's not a system of justice that can avoid that problem, unfortunately.
No, but I sure think a threshold on the front end that might might place some reason in the process and assure that abuses are caught early.
Who would that be, and who would pay for that?
Well, you know, and I don't yet know the mechanics to know.
I don't think we have that big a problem. I mean, I know right now I don't look good saying that because two people have been talking to you for 2 hours about how bad I am. But we don't have that serious a problem. I mean, I approve lots of fees. 99% of them are totally unopposed. Everybody's in agreement with the work that's being done by the lawyers, and nobody's upset. But when you get somebody who has a lot of money, and part of my job is to keep somebody from using the ward's money as a weapon. One child gets in, gets to be guardian, and then the other children are saying, wait a minute, he's not taking care of mom, and he's using the mom's money to fight against him. It's not a contested guardianship. He's just abusing the ward, and he's got all the control of the money.
And, Mr. Chairman, I know we're running out of time, but I have one final question. But if it really, in the end, is not your money, somebody else's money, and your job is to administer the proceedings and to attempt to apply the law and justice fairly. Why really do you care whether or not there's someone looking over your shoulder above a certain threshold as to how this money is released? Why would you care?
I don't care, frankly. I don't care. If the legislature wants to have an army looking over my shoulder, that's fine. But as a conservative, which I sort of am, I'd wonder who's going to pay for the army, who's going to feed the army. Because in a case that's gone on for 11 years and now it's finally going up on appeal and somebody says, well, you never should have done all that, and we want somebody else to look at it, other than the appellate court, who's already going to have to get look at it all, we're going to have an office of court ombudsman, and that office is going to have people in that office, and they're going to have to be paid to do what I have already done with my staff's assistance and to do what the appellate court's going to be doing already. I just don't know why it really helps. I mean, I understand that it would, maybe we'd sleep better at night if we thought somebody was watching out for us. I think I, and I know I'm looking at it from my viewpoint, that I'm the guy with a finger in the dike and taking care of it. But I am not afraid of the legislature having anybody else they want, but I don't think it's practical to do that.
Thank you.
Judge, I hear says one.
Yes, sir.
Judge, the question I had for you has already been asked by the chairman. I saw him on TV ask it, that you can't testify on anything, on an ongoing case in your court. But let me ask you this. Okay, let's take that your case. Case A. And with the kind of testimony that we heard this morning, do you have any recommendations on how to when you hear testimony like that in whoever's court and whoever the judge is, when you hear testimony like that, it automatically raises a red flag with the people out in the community. And do you have any recommendations I wouldn't want anybody testifying like that gentleman just did and his son against anybody, unless
I didn't hear what they said because mm-hmm. I couldn't listen to what they said.
Ongoing case, but what I'm saying
pretty well know
is that for me not to take the wrong impression that whether it be a judge, probate judge from Harris County or Dallas County or Bexar County, that it would seem to me as a non-lawyer that something's wrong and just on first impressions.
All I can say, Senator, is that's why I get paid such a huge salary, is to take the heat from people that are angry. Every contested case has a winner and a loser. And the loser never wants to say it's because I was wrong. He always wants to say, or his lawyer, and bad lawyers do this, the judge is crooked. The judge is corrupt. The judge is in bed with the other side. That's why we lost. We had a good case. The judge it's just the judge's fault. I can't respond to that at all. I can't say a word about that as a judge. No judge can. I have to just be comfortable that I am doing the proper thing myself. And if I don't, the appellate court will reverse me, and that's fine with me. I do my job, and they have a different job. They have more time to look at it, and they have more people to help them look at it. But I really don't read the paper by myself. I don't listen except in open court, so that when they're saying one thing, the other side can say, well, that's not true. That's not true. So I'm hearing both sides of the argument as it's going forward. But I can't keep them. They have a right to say whatever they want to. I can't keep them.
No, I understand it. And then you just got through saying you get paid the big bucks.
Yeah, really.
Just like the chairman and I do, I get paid the big bucks.
He actually does get a little bit more money than we do.
But mine is a full-time job, Senator. No,
I understand. But you know, I guess what I'm saying is that really ultimately these people that are listening to this, whoever they are, you know, for example, my constituents. I mean, I'm going to take the hit because they're going to say, well, they're working under your system, under the legislature. And ultimately, the chairman and I are going to have to take responsibility.
The system has to withstand review, and it has to be open. And maybe the lawyers on the other side of that case will write a book and explain what all went on so that there's an answer. And that's the problem with a free press, you know? And it's even worse with the internet because people can get on and say anything they want without even having to convince the reporter it's a good idea. But we have a free society, and they have a right to their opinions. And I have a job to do. I have to reach the best legal conclusion I can in every case. And I may be right, I may be wrong. I am not dishonest. I'm not going to do something. I mean, you're not saying I am, but every judge that has a rich person who loses, that can get to the public by whatever means, writing a book or getting to the newspaper, is going to get blasted. He's on the other side. He's ruling for his former law partners because he's a friend of theirs or whatever. And we can't say, no, that's not true. We can't say a thing because we can't talk about it in the public. So,
but, Judge, and I understand it. I'm just saying, whether this person be rich or poor, free press or not, whatever, and, you know, they have a say.
Absolutely. And I'm saying they're going to have their say, whatever change you make in the law, mm-hmm. whatever increased scrutiny you have in the probate code.
I mean, but ultimately,
somebody's going to lose, and they're going to say the judge is a crook.
Well, the way I see it and the way that rich or poor is that ultimately that's going to, the responsibility comes here. And that's what I wanted to, the point that I wanted to make.
It's a matter of selling to the public that we really do have the best system, and as far as I'm concerned, the best system in the United States.